Now stay tuned for the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on 94.7 WPVC LP Charlottesville. The Wake-Up Call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Now here's your host, Rick Moore.
And good morning, everybody. Thank you so much for being here with us on another Sunday morning. Today, a little current events. United States and North Korea. So I reached out to the experts. Professor Todd Sexer here with us today, University of Virginia Department of Politics, Frank Batten School of Leadership and Public Policy. Professor Sexer specializes in questions of international security. Research interests include military coercion, reputations in international relations, and the strategic effects of nuclear weapons. So let's talk about international summits and nuclear weapons, which is what we've got going on in current events between United States and North Korea. But you were here back in January, correct?
That's right.
Thank you so much. Only 3 months. I don't always invite guests just 3 months after the last visit, but that's how current events are going between the United States and North Korea. Quick changes in the world. 3 months ago, we didn't expect a summit.
Yes, a lot has happened since we last talked. The situation tends to be very fluid and move very fast.
If we had spoken 3 months ago, would you have predicted, would many people have predicted an international summit between the United States and North Korea?
I don't know that anybody predicted it. I think this was a surprise to most observers that watched the North Korea situation. Now, we should say we don't know yet that it will happen, but it was certainly a surprise announcement.
Back in January, when we spoke, a lot of what we talked about were the names that President Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un were calling one another.
Yeah, they spent most of the summer and fall of 2017 exchanging heated rhetoric over Twitter and calling each other names, and now we have this scheduled summit. Again, it may not happen. We're not there yet, but it certainly looks like all indications right now are that it will.
Now, you've said that twice now. May not happen. Is that because between the United States and North Korea and the leadership that you're not sure, or because that's just the way the world works between any countries and conversations about summits, and sometimes they just don't happen? Or that's these two specific countries, it may not happen.
I think this tends to be the way that the U.S.-North Korean relationship works. That, number one, I'm hesitant to make any firm predictions about what will happen within the relationship because events continue to surprise us, whether it's North Korea advancing its military technology, ballistic missiles, nuclear weapons faster than expected, or whether it's North Korean leader Kim Jong-un making commitments to stop missile testing, stop nuclear testing, seemingly out of the blue. A lot has happened that nobody foresaw. And so, yes, I'm hesitant to make any firm predictions that the summit will actually happen. And the third reason is North Korea is notorious for making promises and raising expectations that aren't met. So this summit may very well not happen. We don't know what will happen in the next month, the intervening weeks between now and the summit. But again, at the moment, there's no reason, no particular reason to be skeptical other than knowing the history of the U.S.-North Korean relationship, which is not a particularly favorable one.
Professor Todd Sexer here on Sunday morning wake-up call as we talk about United States and North Korea. So let me state, and I'll state this early, and I'll probably state this multiple times throughout the hour. We are pre-recording this program, and so we may not be up to date on something that has just happened or recently happened in the news. And so forgive us if we don't have last night's tidbit, because both of these leaders are likely to do something after we've sat down to talk about this the day that we're recording this program. Because just in the last week, in the last day or two, surprising bits of information have happened, and we'll get to those throughout the hour with Professor Sexer. Professor, we did this in January. I want to bring this up again. Your dissertation won the 2008 Walter Izard Award for Best Dissertation in Peace Science. I want to have the listeners know what that was about, because peace science seems like something that would be quite helpful in the United States, North Korea Peace Summit.
Yeah, the award was given for social scientific research on questions of war and peace. It's given by the Peace Science Society International, and the purpose is to recognize good work that's taking place in the social science community on questions of international conflict. So what I wrote about was a surprising pattern that we see in international politics, which is weak countries like North Korea, that stand up to larger countries. And we think of the U.S.-North Korean relationship maybe as anomalous, maybe as something unique that happens only once in a while. But actually, it's quite common for smaller countries to stand up to the United States and to other larger powers. The United States, actually, since the end of the Cold War, has had a pretty poor record trying to coerce small countries like Panama or Serbia or Iraq. We often see that these countries stand up to U.S. attempts to coerce them, North Korea, I think, being the latest example of that. And so my research, both in my doctoral dissertation and since then at the University of Virginia, has explored why.
And why?
Well, I think part of the dynamic taking place is that a country like the United States has unique advantages in international politics. We have the ability to project military power. We can put missiles and kinetic force anywhere in the world on a moment's notice. And that has a lot of advantages, but there are also, I think, some unanticipated drawbacks that come along with that military power. And the main drawback or the main limitation is that countries have to worry that when we ask them to do something and they acquiesce to our demands, they have to worry about what acquiescing is going to communicate to us. So think of the child on the elementary school playground who's being pushed around by a bigger kid. If you give him your lunch money the first time, well, you know what's going to happen the next day and the day after that. He's going to continue to ask more and more of you. And smaller countries, I think, recognize this problem. And we often see Slobodan Milosevic in 1999 standing up to the United States. Saddam Hussein, Muammar Gaddafi stood up to the United States for a long time. Manuel Noriega, this long list of many dictators who have stood up to U.S. coercion. And I think part of the reason is that they have to think about what they're telling us when they acquiesce to our demands. They don't want to look weak. They don't want to look irresolute, because there are big disadvantages and big costs to them for doing that. So we often see that they fight, and they fight back, even expecting that they'll lose, because what they're doing is they're playing a much longer game. And I think actually in the North Korea case, we're seeing much of that take place, where the North Koreans have refused American demands over not just the last year, but several decades. And I think part of the game that the North Koreans are playing is a very long-term game that they're thinking about. If they look weak to the United States today, what are the costs going to be tomorrow? What is the U.S. going to ask them to do tomorrow that they're not willing to do?
Our guest today, Professor Todd Sexer from UVA's Department of Politics. Professor, so it wasn't that long ago that former Secretary of State Rex Tillerson had disagreeing statements with President Trump. Mr. Tillerson was talking about possibly sitting down with North Korea, and President Trump was saying no. And now Mr. Tillerson is gone. He was fired. And many people believe that that was one of the major reasons, was because of such those type of disagreements. Can you talk a bit about Mr. Tillerson's thoughts for why they should sit down, and the relationship between Secretary of State Tillerson and North Korea at the time, why he thought that could happen?
Well, I don't have any special insight into the Trump administration's diplomatic strategy with North Korea. I think it's possible that the president allowed the Secretary of State to try out as sort of a trial balloon some conciliatory statements about sitting down with North Korea as a signal that he might be willing to do it. So we saw this interesting dynamic where the Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, would make these suggestions, I'll call them, that the U.S. might be willing to negotiate with North Korea. And then those statements would be repudiated by the president very publicly, very shortly thereafter. So, you know, one explanation for that is that the Secretary of State was sort of going off the reservation, didn't have authorization to make those statements, and then would be rebuffed by the president. But I think another possibility is that they were really just trial balloons to try to test what the North Korean reaction would be and see if they might be amenable to some kind of a summit or maybe negotiations at a lower level like we're seeing today. And then also, we this is not the only time that the president's public statements have been inconsistent with behavior, negotiating behavior that's taking place in private, where we just found out in the last few days that the former director of the CIA, soon to be the new Secretary of State, Pompeo, took a secret trip to North Korea to discuss a possible summit, even at the same time that in public the president was making bellicose statements about North Korea and negotiating seemed like it was out of the question. So the private negotiating behavior and the public statements of the Trump administration are sometimes at odds, and that's not unusual.
So let's talk for a minute about Mike Pompeo. You say future Secretary of State. Do you think that he's going to get that job? I mean, you have someone like Ron Paul, Senator Ron Paul, who, if you follow the news, he's someone who's being listed as against Mike Pompeo, and if there are enough Democrat votes, Mike Pompeo may not get the job.
I'm not a congressional politics expert. You're going to need somebody else.
Somebody else to come in and talk that part?
If you want to make predictions about what will happen in Congress. I suppose it's always possible, and there does seem to be a little bit of skepticism. Certainly among the Democrats, some senators were not happy to hear about the North Korea trip that he took, because apparently he didn't reveal that even in private discussions with some senators. But at the same time, it is well above my pay grade to make predictions about individual votes of senators or confirmation hearings.
Do we know why North Korea would even let him in? He's, at this point, he's still a spy, not a diplomat.
I think to the extent that they believed he speaks for the Trump administration, that kind of meeting would be attractive. And I think one of the costs of allowing or having the Secretary of State, Tillerson, make statements in public that were then repudiated by the president is perhaps it created some doubt or some uncertainty about whether the secretary really spoke for the president. And once a foreign government stops believing that a diplomat or a cabinet official really has the president's ear, then they lose a lot of credibility as a negotiating partner, because why waste your time negotiating with somebody that isn't speaking for the administration that they work for? So to the extent that they believe Pompeo was a more credible voice for the president, that would be attractive.
How similar do you believe the North Korean president and the United States president are in personality?
I have absolutely no idea how similar they are, having not met either of them. You know, I think one of the
just the way that they're acting in terms of trying to put this summit together. Let's limit it a little bit to that.
Well, I think one of the features of Kim Jong-un is that we know so little about him and his personality and his negotiating behavior. This summit will be interesting if it happens, because it will provide a window into what Kim Jong-un is really like. And we really don't know. North Korea is, for the most part, at least the North Korean government, is really a black box. And that makes negotiating with them difficult. When you compare, you know, how we negotiated with the Soviets in the 1970s and 1980s, you know, our intelligence apparatus was very closely following every individual that could potentially have influence within the Soviet government. You know, watching the Kremlin was a favorite sport in Washington, D.C. Who's up, who's down, who's in, who's out. And with North Korea, we just don't have access to that level of information. So we know a lot less about what's happening inside their government. We know a lot less about the individual characteristics of their leaders. It seems to be the case that both Kim and President Trump believe that they have something to gain from having this summit. And so we see, you know, President Trump raising expectations about what he might be able to accomplish. We see Kim making commitments even before the summit begins about putting a stop to nuclear and missile testing. And it seems to be a case of at least raising expectations to some extent, and both leaders seem to think they have something to gain from doing that. Now, we'll see what the summit really ends up producing in terms of a real result. And it might be nothing, but it could also be an agreement that we're not anticipating yet.
Again, our guest today, Professor Todd Sexer from the Frank Batten School of Leadership and Public Policy, as we talk about the United States and North Korea, some of the current events, the planned summit. This is a pre-recorded program, so there may be some recent events that have taken place that we don't discuss during the hour. Please forgive us if that's the case. Do we know where they'll meet?
I don't think a meeting location, as far as I know, has not been released yet.
And I asked that knowing the answer, one of the topics that I had read was that there were concerns by North Korea that they didn't want the destination to be too far away because they didn't have pretty planes for the Korean leader to fly on and arrive on. But they didn't want the destination to be too close for President Trump either. You know, it's this whole process of who wins for, you know, for the choice for that. So much like anything else, it's all about where you choose is the first choice of who wins the summit question.
Well, this is one of the features of international summits, is that symbolism matters a great deal because there is so much hype, because there's so much public attention given to these meetings. Every detail matters. And that's part of the reason that people were so surprised, observers were so surprised, that this summit was announced on very short notice with no apparent planning, at least in public, by either North Korea or the Trump administration. And these summits take a long time to prepare. You start by negotiating about how to negotiate. Where will the meeting take place? Who will be invited? What is the shape of the negotiating table? Who gets off the plane first? Who greets whom? These things are always very tightly choreographed, and they take a long time to plan. And so it's hard to throw one of these things together. Even in just a few weeks, it takes a long time. And that's without even talking about what is the substance of the meeting.
All right. Let's take our first break. We'll be right back. All right. Back in action here with Professor Sexer, talking about the summit, the planned summit, because we don't have an actual summit in action yet. Professor, so the reason that we're having this summit planned is because of North Korea's nuclear weaponry there. How did they get to be such a concern? I mean, people think of North Korea in many ways as a third world country. Now, I don't know if that's true or accurate in terms of, I don't want to diss anybody, but we think of Haiti because of many of the storms that have taken place. But for North Korea, how can they be... go from, what, 5 years ago? Is that a fair assessment? To today or last year, the concern is that they have the ability to shoot intercontinental ballistic missiles, I'll say ICBMs, all the way to the United States and certainly to Japan. How did they get so far so rapidly?
Persistence is the short answer. The longer answer is that it really hasn't been that rapid, because they've been working on ballistic missiles and nuclear weapons for a quarter century, really much longer than that. The last, think of the Clinton administration dealt with this very same problem in 1994 with North Korea's nuclear program and their advancing ballistic missiles. And that led to an agreement between the United States and North Korea, which ultimately dissolved. With both sides accusing each other of cheating and not meeting their obligations under the agreement. But North Korea has been pursuing nuclear weapons for a long, long time. Now, the surprise in the last, say, 2 years or year and a half, is that the country seems to have gone from having very limited ballistic missile capabilities to now having, as you say, the ability to potentially hit the United States. Now, they haven't conclusively demonstrated that they can actually do that, but extrapolating from the tests that we've been able to observe, it looks like they might be able to. That has happened very quickly. And just a few years ago, North Korea was really a technological laughingstock, at least from a nuclear and missile perspective, and their technological progress for the last year and a half has been very quick. Now, again, that in the long term, we shouldn't exaggerate how fast that has been, because it has been decades. And it took, the United States, the Soviet Union, countries that have ballistic missiles with that range, far less time to make those technological leaps. But by devoting a huge share of its GDP to defense and to nuclear and ballistic missile research, North Korea's been able to pull it off. But, you know, that shouldn't disguise the fact that for the average North Korean citizen, everyday life is like living in a third. I mean, it is not like living in a third world country. It is a third world country from a, you know, in, the perspective of an average citizen. It's just the nuclear and missile program that has received so much funding, so much of North Korea's resources that they've been able to make these advancements.
Is this all intrastate, or are they getting assistance from other countries? Like China is often, by the United States anyway, accused of assisting them.
They've received some assistance with uranium enrichment, plutonium reprocessing from China, from the Soviet Union in the early days. But at least to our knowledge, these big advancements in ballistic missile technology, it's not like they're buying ICBMs off the shelf from China or from Russia. These are mostly, as far as we can tell, indigenous improvements.
They have accidents or explosions. Are these tests? Are they, you know, intentional or are they accidental? You know, when you see them with earthquakes and mountain collapses.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, as far as I know, there is no indication that any of their nuclear tests were accidental detonations. They seem to be intentional. Now, there's a concern that their test site, their nuclear test site, because of the seismic effect of nuclear tests, might not be seismically stable or geologically stable. And so this recent offer that they've made to voluntarily shut down the test site, again, might not be a concession at all. It might be necessity, something that they're going to have to do anyway because of the geological instability of the test site, the earthquakes that are happening. And so they're shutting it down involuntarily rather than as a conciliatory move on the part of the Kim regime. The progress that they have made in the last couple of years is more on the missile side, but also on the nuclear weapon side. They seem to have been able to shrink the size of their nuclear warheads, which is an important move because you need a smaller size warhead to be able to put it on top of a ballistic missile.
So let's talk about that. You mentioned a piece of the news that has just come out from when we're pre-recording the show. Trying to find my notes here where I actually wrote this down. But North Korea has announced that they will shut down their nuclear program. And for many people are saying, oh, they're making the first step. And although the summit hasn't begun, this is the first step in someone in one of the countries saying, here you go, now it's your turn. Talk a little bit about that.
The promise that they have made, again, a unilateral statement, was that they have reached the level of technological progress that they sought on their nuclear program and that they will stop testing nuclear weapons. Now, the United States has also stopped testing nuclear weapons. We haven't tested nuclear weapons in decades. But at the same time, that what's important to remember is the promise that North Korea did not make, which was a promise to give up their ballistic missiles or to give up their nuclear weapons. They haven't made any commitment of that sort. They've agreed, it seems, to talk about that possibility, but it's not a commitment they've made. So that's important to remember, is that even if they stop testing nuclear weapons, that doesn't mean they're giving them up, and it doesn't mean they're willing to give them up. We will see what happens.
So I'd like to know what the goal or what the believed goal of both countries is going to this summit.
The Trump administration has not identified a list of objectives yet, at least publicly. It certainly seems that the president has an ambition to get North Korea to give up its nuclear and missile program and its nuclear weapons and its ballistic missiles. That would be an ideal outcome, I think, for the United States. For the North Koreans, again, we don't know for sure what their objectives are, but I think that one of the goals of this summit is to establish themselves as a legitimate negotiating partner with the United States. It raises their stature, and it raises the stature of Kim Jong-un himself to have this summit. And, you know, you could read North Korea's strategy in one of two ways. An optimist would say that sanctions and international pressure have brought North Korea to the bargaining table, and that they've realized that their economy will continue to suffer and the country will continue to stagnate unless they make concessions on the nuclear and missile side. A pessimist would say that North Korea has made these kinds of promises before. They've raised expectations in the United States, and American leaders have been disappointed every time. Pessimists would also say that North Korea probably sees their nuclear weapons as a critical defense asset, critical to the protection of the North Korean regime, and that they are making these moves only as a way of raising expectations so that if the summit either doesn't happen or if the summit fails, then they will blame it on the United States and try to gain some political points by doing that. Which one is true? I don't know the answer, but you could really read these moves in either way.
Do you believe that North Korea is preparing for the proposed summit with another country? And, you know, is China assisting them and saying, you should do this? This is how you should sit down at the table and discuss. And whether that's, and I don't mean that strictly in terms of this is what you should ask for, although that's part of the question, but in terms of this is how you go to a summit.
I don't know how the North Korean regime is preparing, you know, at least logistically, for these kinds of negotiations. I'm sure that the Chinese leadership has preferences and ideas of what they would like to see Kim talk about or not talk about at the summit. Now, whether Kim is willing to accept that kind of guidance, I don't know. I would guess that the Chinese leadership, maybe Russian leadership, are at least communicating with the North Koreans about what they would like to see happen. But again, I don't know whether Kim will take their advice or not.
Our guest today, Professor Todd Sexer, University of Virginia Department of Politics, as we talk about the United States and the North Korean proposed summit. Who do you think has a bigger role or stake in North Korea's outcome, China or Russia? That both of those countries keep coming up when we talk about North Korea.
I think China has a big stake in this outcome for a couple of reasons. One is China's interest in North Korea has always been in stability. What the Chinese want to avoid is a North Korea that is unstable, a government that collapses. Either, you know, what one possible outcome of a collapse of the North Korean government could be literally hundreds of thousands of economic refugees on China's border. So the Chinese military has been planning for this outcome for a long time. But, you know, just because they have a plan for it doesn't mean that executing that plan wouldn't be costly. It would be costly. So the Chinese have always been reluctant to support stringent sanctions against the North Korean economy because they don't want to undermine the stability of the North Korean regime. I think a second interest that China has in this crisis in particular is partly keeping the U.S. involved, but not too involved. The Chinese want to avoid, I think, conflict on the Korean Peninsula, certainly want to avoid that, in part because the outcome would be bad for the North Korean government. If the U.S. and North Korea go to war, I think the only outcome in the end is going to be the end of the North Korean regime. And the Chinese know this, and what they don't want is the Korean Peninsula that's unified under the protection of the United States with U.S. bases and the U.S. military in North Korea. Right? We saw, you know, 8 years ago, we saw the Chinese government willing to go to war against the United States to prevent the defeat of the North Korean government. This was the impetus for the Chinese involvement in the Korean War in 1950. So I think the Chinese government wants to avoid that outcome. But I think even in a more long-term sense, I think the Chinese government benefits in part from keeping the U.S. distracted in East Asia. And this crisis keeps the U.S. bogged down. It keeps the U.S. government paying attention to North Korea instead of China. And, you know, the U.S. government talks about the Korean Peninsula instead of Chinese military modernization or the South China Sea or other moves that the Chinese government is making. So I think they're, in the long term, having this crisis sort of on a low boil in the long run is very beneficial for the Chinese government.
37 minutes after the hour, talking about the United States and North Korea with UVA's Professor Todd Sexer. So what about Russia? What are Russia's interests in this conversation with UVA and UVA with USA and North Korea?
I think their interests are somewhat similar in the latter sense, that it's beneficial for the Russians to see the U.S. bogged down and to have the U.S. distracted and not paying attention to what the Russian military is doing and plans that they're making. Now, whether that is successful, I'm skeptical. You know, we saw the most recent nuclear strategy document that was produced by the Trump administration talk a great deal about Russia's military doctrine. So it's not as if the U.S. military is thinking only about the Korean Peninsula and not about Russia or China, for that matter. But I think from a grand strategy perspective, there are benefits to Russia in having the U.S. distracted and devoting a lot of resources and attention to the Korean Peninsula, which ultimately is a place that the Russians, I think, don't have a strong interest in.
President Trump is not known for studying or preparation. Do you think that that would be a problem? Is he going to allow others to do the work at this summit, assuming it takes place?
I think we just don't know the answer to that. You know, number one is there might be a lot of things taking place behind the scenes. I think the Pompeo visit to North Korea is a good reminder that in public, at least, we don't know everything that's going on. But what you said, I think, was right, which is that the president doesn't necessarily have a lot of expertise, certainly doesn't have a lot of expertise on the Korean crisis. The extent to which he's willing to take advice or guidance from his advisors, I think, is unclear. We've seen, you know, take this Syria crisis, for example, where the Secretary of Defense, Jim Mattis, wanted to get congressional approval before striking Syria with cruise missiles and airstrikes, and the president overruled him and said, we're going to go ahead and conduct the strikes without congressional approval. So just because the president has advisors doesn't mean he's willing to listen to them, and even if he listens, it doesn't mean he's willing to take their advice. And I think in the case of North Korea, we just don't know what advice he's getting and what advice he's taking. It will all be a big surprise, I think, when it does happen.
40 minutes after the hour, we'll take our break and be right back. And we're back with Professor Sexer today. Frank Batten, School of Leadership and Public Policy, UVA's Department of Politics, bringing his expertise to the studio as we talk about the United States and North Korea and the planned, but not yet happening, summit. Professor, when you were here before, we had a enlightening conversation, or I guess I was the student listening to your conversation about the madman theory. And I'd like to hear that again for listeners or podcast listeners who didn't catch up on that, because it seems like in this situation with these two leaders, this is an important piece of information, especially you're talking about nuclear weaponry, and I'd like you to talk about that again.
Well, the madman theory is an idea that was developed during the Cold War by nuclear strategists who were facing the problem of how to make nuclear threats credible. And one solution that they came up with was pretend or act erratically, act like you are irrational or a little bit crazy. Now, what that exactly means, I think, is unclear, but Richard Nixon took the idea seriously, and he's the one who coined the term madman theory. And he employed a strategy with respect to the Soviet Union during the Vietnam War of trying to convey to the Soviets that he was a little bit erratic, a little bit crazy, and by extension, maybe willing to launch or fight a nuclear war. Now, it's, you know, President Trump has made some statements that are consistent with that idea. He's made statements like it's important to be unpredictable. It is bad to be too predictable. You want to keep your enemies guessing about what you're going to do. And there may be some virtue in that. It's worth saying, though, that it did not work for Nixon, who tried the strategy in 1969 in negotiating with the Soviets over Vietnam, and it didn't work at all. The Soviets were confused by his behavior. They did not infer, as he had hoped, that he was crazy or irrational. That's a tough message to convey. And even further, if you really believe that your adversary is irrational or crazy, then it's hard to make the case that you should acquiesce to what they're asking and that they will behave more rationally or more more sane after you acquiesce. If you're facing an adversary, think of somebody like Osama bin Laden, who was believed by, you know, U.S. leaders to be a little bit fanatical, maybe a little bit crazy. The last thing you want to do is make concessions to somebody like that because you don't want to whet their appetite for further aggression. So, you know, there's no evidence, as far as I can tell, that President Trump or Kim Jong-un believe that they have to act like a madman in this particular crisis. But that strategy, I think, has not worked all that well historically.
Can you tell us what is South Korea's role in all this? The new South Korean leader, the name of the South Korean leader, I have it here, and I won't pretend that I can pronounce it properly. Moon Jae-in.
Moon Jae-in. That's right.
But since the South Korean leader has taken over, there has been an attempt to bring the two countries together in much closer ties. And now I'm just curious as to, is South Korea going to participate in the summit or possibly host the summit? And again, as we talked about, there's no guarantee on where the summit will be hosted, but sort of be a host, whether or not it's in their country or just be, you know, the host in terms of, hi, let me, you know, let me be the person to say hello, you know, hold hands here for the two of you. But what is the role of South Korea as the third country between North Korea and the United States?
Well, South Korea seems to be enthusiastic about the possibility of a kind of rapprochement between the U.S. and North Korea, and they've been enthusiastic about that for a long time. In, as far as their formal role in the summit, we don't know what that will be. We just don't know many details really at all about this planned summit. But, of course, their role as a U.S. ally cannot be overlooked. Their enthusiasm is strong for the U.S. and North Korea to reach some kind of a compromise that would improve their relationship and reduce the likelihood of a conflict in the Korean Peninsula. I mean, we have to remember that, yes, there are, you know, almost 30,000 U.S. troops and a couple of 100,000 U.S. citizens in South Korea. But the reality is, in any war in the Korean Peninsula, the brunt of the costs are going to be paid by South Koreans and North Koreans. Furthermore, there are still families, many families in South Korea, that were split at the beginning of the Cold War, at the end of the Korean War, when you know, families that half were in North Korea and half in South Korea, that either have not been able to see each other at all or have been able to see each other only on a very limited basis. So that aspect of South Korea's interest, I think, is very strong in trying to push for an agreement. So we often see that South Korean officials, we often see them making more optimistic and more hopeful statements, not just about this summit, but about the U.S.-North Korean relationship. In part, I think, because they're very hopeful that there will be a compromise.
Don't North Korea and South Korea, don't they already have a new peace accord themselves?
Well, there's never been a formal end to the Korean War, so a formal peace treaty that ended the war in 1953. It ended with an armistice. So if there were to be a formal peace treaty, presumably, yes, South Korea would need to be involved. But we don't have a formal peace treaty yet. Now, one of the surprises of the Pompeo visit to North Korea was that he appeared, or at least public reports indicate that he signaled to the North Koreans that the U.S. might be willing to talk about a peace treaty that would end the war. And that's surprising because the U.S. has not been willing to talk about a peace treaty thus far, up until now. And I think part of the reason is that, you know, Japan, for example, is skeptical of that outcome. If there were a peace treaty between the U.S. and North Korea, then that might undermine the justification for having U.S. troops in South Korea or maybe in East Asia more broadly. And, you know, the Japanese government in particular has been skeptical for that reason. They don't want to provide any excuse for the U.S. to reduce its presence in East Asia. But that may be one of the possible outcomes of this summit, is that even if there's no formal peace treaty to come out of it, there may be progress that the two countries make toward signing that kind of an accord.
Professor Todd Sexer here today with us as we talk about the United States and North Korea and some of the current events going on in conversation about a potential peace summit. Again, we are pre-recording this program, so if we're overlooking conversation about recent news, we apologize. It may have happened since we recorded this program. There was conversation from President Trump. He declared that he would scrap a planned summit meeting or even walk out of the session while it's underway if things were not heading towards success. Now, as someone whose research includes military coercion and reputation and international relations, I'd like your thoughts on that.
Well, I think from the president's perspective, what he doesn't want to do is communicate that he's willing to keep talking if the North Koreans appear intransigent. So he's trying to establish a little bit of resolve, set the right tone that the U.S. is willing to negotiate, but not willing to negotiate forever. And with the North Koreans, you know, if the historical record repeats itself, any negotiation, any agreement with the North Koreans will take a very long time to reach. So I think the president's trying to communicate a little bit of impatience. He wants to show that he's not willing to make any concessions to get an agreement with North Korea, which is a reasonable stand to take, I think. He wants to show that he's willing to talk, but not infinitely willing to talk.
Now, the State Department recently lost its chief North Korean negotiator, who retired from the State Department. Do you believe that for the summit, that for such events, that career negotiators are important to these type of events? Or that someone can come in who is a good bipartisan person and do these things?
My view is that career diplomats are critical. And it's true that the State Department right now is very much understaffed. The U.S. doesn't have an ambassador, for example, to South Korea. There was talk of appointing one in December and January, and then that appointment was scrapped. And I think that is a drawback and a disadvantage for the United States. A seasoned and experienced diplomat can help tell the president and other negotiators what to expect. They can teach them a lot about the history of North Korean behavior or negotiations with the North Koreans. That doesn't mean that the Trump administration won't get that perspective at all. They do have some people in the administration with that background, with that experience, but having career diplomats, I think, is critical. And having all these key posts in the State Department not filled, yes, I think it's a strategic disadvantage for the United States walking into a high-stakes, high-visibility summit like this one.
Now, there are three Americans being held in North Korea. Do you think that that these three Americans will play a role in the summit?
We just don't know. The president has not made any statements about making their release a condition for either negotiating or for signing an agreement with North Korea. Now, will he make that a condition? It's possible. But again, we don't know, and the president really has not shown his cards on that issue of whether these three Americans will become a major issue at the summit.
Do you know, I don't have this history, I didn't take my notes. Do we know how long they've been there?
I don't know, no.
We haven't talked any about economic sanctions. I would think, and I'm just guessing, I have no history, no knowledge, no expertise, as I invited you on for this in this area. But I'm guessing that the whole effort of North Korea to even have this summit is economic sanctions are an important part of why they're doing this. We talk about third world country. It's got to be at some point a problem. And so I'm asking you to talk about economic sanctions for a bit here.
Well, certainly the United States government believes that economic pressure is important to getting North Korea to the bargaining table. It seems like in the case of Iran, that economic sanctions were a success story, that one of the Iranian government's motivations to negotiate with the U.S., back during the Obama administration over the nuclear deal that we signed with them was this strong regime of sanctions, international sanctions, not just American sanctions, that were imposed on the Iranian economy. Now, in the case of North Korea, North Korea has been subject to much more long-standing and also much more severe sanctions than Iran was. But at the same time, the North Koreans have an economic relationship with China. China is by far North Korea's most important trading partner. North Korea sells a lot of coal to China, which they value very highly. And the Chinese have been reluctant to support extremely stringent sanctions against North Korea. And they've always been an obstacle. The Chinese government has always been an obstacle to that. So the U.S. government continues to push. Back in, I think, December, January, there was a new round of sanctions imposed by the U.N. Security Council against North Korea. But at the same time, I think it's tough to draw a connection between North Korea's willingness to negotiate and these economic sanctions, just because the sanctions have been in place for so long and have had so little effect, not on the North Korean economy. That effect has been very severe. But the effect that has been limited is the effect on the North Korean government. And they've managed to be able to continue to devote resources to key figures in the North Korean government, to the military, and to their nuclear and missile program. Now, whether the U.S. could get international support for more severe sanctions, I don't know. I'm skeptical. I think we're probably about as far as we can go without getting past the threshold where China or Russia would start opposing them. But I think it's tough to draw the conclusion that sanctions are really responsible for what we're seeing now.
2 minutes left with Professor Sexer talking about United States and North Korea and the proposed summit. So we talk about sanctions, and we've been talking about nuclear weaponry as being a key part of the proposed and planned summit. How would the weaponry issue be verifiable if the goal is to take the weaponry away or reduce the weaponry so that the sanctions can be reduced? How do you verify that the nuclear issues are reduced? Because that was President Trump's or pre-President Trump's complaint about the Obama administration and Iran.
Yeah, I think verification is one of these tricky issues that, you know, seems small. It seems like a technical term. But really, it's the whole ballgame. If verification is a condition for an agreement with North Korea, it's very difficult to see how 100% reliable verification could be imposed on the North Korean government. If we don't know even where all their weapons are today or their stockpiles of uranium and plutonium, and it's not clear that we know, it's very difficult to see how 100% verifiability standard could be met in any agreement with North Korea next month.
Amazing. I've had a fascinating hour. I hope that you'll come back in the future and talk to us again about it after the planned summit. Will you do that?
I would be happy to. Thanks.
Thanks so much. Professor Todd Sexer, University of Virginia, Department of Politics, Frank Batten School of Leadership and Public Policy. Next week, we'll have ACLU Virginia on. Hope you'll listen in again. Thanks, everybody.
This has been the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on 94.7, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. The Wake-Up Call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Production assistance and engineering from Sean McCord and Mike Friend. Be sure to join Rick next Sunday morning at 11 a.m. for the Wake-Up Call, only on WPVC LP Charlottesville.